From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Santa Clara.
Santa Cruz.
Union City.
Hayward.
San Francisco.
I'm from Fremont.
Yo, I'm San Jose, just downtown.
Coming up, we'll visit San Francisco's public piers where fishermen catch food for themselves and their families, but at a risk.
Some of the fish that live in San Francisco Bay have mercury in them, and certain kinds of fish have lots of mercury in them.
Then we'll speak with new UC Berkeley Chancellor Nicholas Dirks about steering the university through tough financial times.
The increase has just been almost unthinkable.
And we'll examine what it would mean to sell the historic downtown Berkeley post office.
What we've forgotten is that these buildings are unique to the United States, and they're palaces in our major cities.
Finding new directions, that's all coming up today on Cross Currents. Going fishing is a beloved summer pastime for many Californians, but the state just issued new guidelines for eating fish from many of California's lakes and rivers. In short, they say be careful. In particular, children and women between 18 and 45 should avoid eating bass, carp, and some brown trout because of dangerously high levels of methylmercury. Mercury contamination is especially high throughout Northern California, and it's also a concern right here in the San Francisco Bay. Every year, hundreds of fishermen from Marin to Martinez try their luck on the public fishing piers off San Francisco's Embarcadero. Some are hobbyists, but in a tight economy, many more are catching meals for their families. And that means that mercury and other toxins could be finding their way onto a greater number of dinner plates. About a year and a half ago, reporter Julia Scott met some of those fishermen. Here's her story.
It's crab season in California, and commercial fishermen can't unload their catches fast enough to satisfy the crowds filling Fisherman's Wharf. But out on the public piers behind the Embarcadero, away from the big boats, you'll find a different breed of fishermen. They set out their poles, unroll their lines, add some bait, and wait quietly for dinner to arrive. These are subsistence fishermen, men like Mr. Chen, who prefers a pier near the end of the ferry building. He didn't want his first name used. Mr. Chen's fished here for a few years, and since 2008 or so, when the economy tanked, he's had plenty of company.
I've been here a long time. The fish have been dwindling.
Community outreach workers say a growing number of people, often poor Asians and African Americans, are dining out at the piers. More people fishing means there are fewer fish to go around, which makes the ones Mr. Chen can catch all the more precious.
I just learned how to fish. If I catch anything, it's smelt.
It's an enticing prospect. Aspiring fishermen on local shores can expect salmon, croaker, sturgeon, even the occasional rock crab, all for free. But there's a big trade-off.
Some of the fish that live in San Francisco Bay have mercury in them.
Margie Gassell works for the State Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment.
Actually, most fish have mercury in them, and certain kinds of fish have lots of mercury in them.
Gassell's worried that mercury, PCBs, and other industrial chemicals could make fishermen like Mr. Chen sick, and that they won't know until they're very sick.
People aren't going to get obviously sick after eating fish, but the contaminants can build up in their bodies and can cause harm.
The metals' effects on adults aren't well known, but mercury poisoning can cause serious disabilities in newborns, and that's why pregnant women are supposed to stay away from fish. So when they realized how high mercury levels were in fish from the bay, Gassell's agency considered outlawing fishing altogether. Ultimately, they decided to issue a new fish advisory that put some fish off limits to some people. For example, children and women between the ages of 18 and 45 should never eat surf perch, striped bass, sharks, or sturgeon from the bay. Men should keep it to no more than one serving per week.
Yeah, people talk. People always talk. Heavy metal pollution, right? Radiation pollution?
To fishermen like Mr. Chen, mercury poisoning is an abstract concept compared with hunger. Chen says he's not really focusing on it.
There's a lot of pollution out there, but I can't worry about everything.
And it's like, we just get fish as fish, food as food. You know, you get what you get. If you're hungry, you eat it. How can you say, you know, rationalize it or, like, you know, proportion the fish or the consumption?
That's from Mari Safan. She works with APA Family Support Services, a collection of community groups that does health and crisis intervention with Asian and Pacific Islander families.
When you go fishing, you bring a fish home, you cook the food. You don't cook the food for different members of the family. And you don't say, okay, here, you only get this little portion. And because you're only five and you're a girl.
Safan says the fish warnings often miss the mark with families, if they hear them at all. Many fishers don't speak English, and some are illiterate.
Hi, Jennifer.
That's why the California Department of Public Health hired APA Family Support Services and three other agencies to reach out to these fishermen. Over the next 6 months, they'll translate the fish advisory pamphlet into several languages, including Cambodian, Samoan, and Korean. They'll spend time on the piers, finding out what kind of fish people are catching and whom they're eating it with. A survey taken in 2001 found that most fishermen earn less than $20,000 a year, and that 1 in 10 was eating unsafe amounts of fish. Officials have never measured how many subsistence fishermen are out on the bay, but Gesell says they're in the thousands.
To date, I don't think anybody has really figured out how to find subsistence fishers. We just kind of know or have a sense that there are people who rely a lot on fish for food.
Safan says what they've learned so far suggests finances trump health concerns every time.
You know, why do a fish versus, you know, let's say a cup of noodle? A cup of noodle will probably feed one person barely for one meal, but a fish can feed three or four person in a family and can even, you know, you can even use like every part of the fish.
Safan herself is familiar with this quandary. Her family's from Laos, and they fish too. So what happens when they bring fish home from the bay that she knows she shouldn't eat?
I don't decline, actually. So, I don't know, it's a family pressure, cultural pressure, or, you know, because it looks really good. So when they prepare, they catch the fish, they prepare it, you know, of course I'm going to eat it.
Some Asian families tell Safan they can't understand why they shouldn't feed their children fish. She knows just what they're going through.
I have a 3-year-old daughter, you know, as long as the bones are out and it's safe to eat in that aspect, then, you know, we eat it. I do feel that dilemma as far as, you know, do I not give my daughter this food even though I learned about this advisory?
It's an issue fishing families will have to contend with for years to come, and one that health officials will continue to watch. In San Francisco, I'm Julia Scott for Cross Currents.
Have you ever fished in the San Francisco Bay? Do you worry about what's in your fish? Call us and let us know at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message and we'll try to put your story on the air. The number is 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. And now we'll turn our attention to another state program, the University of California. The UC system saw a major change in administration earlier this summer when Janet Napolitano was appointed president. When she takes office in September, the former Homeland Security Secretary will be the first woman to hold the presidential position. UC Berkeley's administration also experienced a change this past June when Nicholas Dirks was sworn in as the university's chancellor, the faculty's highest-ranking position. One of Dirks' primary obligations in his new role is to find new funding for the university. And that's more important than ever. The numbers are stark. 10 years ago, a semester for a resident undergrad at UC Berkeley was under $3,000. This semester, the state provides only about 11% of funding, and tuition is 2.5 times higher. I spoke with Chancellor Dirks about how UC Berkeley has felt the effects of this financial gap.
I think it's been, you know, it's been traumatic at every level. It's been traumatic, obviously, for students with tuition increases. It's been traumatic for staff. And, of course, it's been traumatic for faculty because they've seen packages and compensation and research support at other universities, some public, but of course many private, get more and more robust over the last few years when there have just been nothing but cutbacks here in the university. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that there is huge commitment to this university, to Berkeley, to the University of California system, and to the fact that it is a public institution. So that even now with 11% of the funding coming from the state, much less than was the case even 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, you have a sense that there is a really, really strong public mission on the part of all the different constituencies on campus. There's a sense that that public mission means operating at a level and in ways that are profoundly different than goes on in the private sector. And that involves doing research with a sense of the importance of the public good that comes out of it. It means doing what one can to mitigate the costs of higher education for students. 40% of Berkeley students, in fact, pay no tuition at all. There are more Pell Grant recipients at the University of California and Berkeley alone than in the entire Ivy League combined. So there has been a huge commitment to continuing to make the access that used to, of course, be part of the virtually, you know, zero levels of tuition.
1960 master plan, yeah.
The 1960 master plan has continued in an odd way, counterintuitive way, through all these different kinds of efforts to maintain a strong commitment to access.
And so what's your plan? I mean, one of the things that I've read about your tenure is that you're a good fundraiser.
The current campaign at Berkeley, which was commenced in 2008 and which will conclude by the end of this calendar year, set a target that seemed pretty difficult to reach, particularly given what was going on in the economy in 2008. And it was a target of $3 billion, and we will achieve it. No sooner than we achieve that, we'll begin planning for the next campaign. And yes, I mean, the experience that I've had fundraising, I think, will come in to be extremely important here because we need to think about supporting the university in ways that obviously go well beyond the kinds of expectations for state support that used to just be taken for granted.
And do you have concerns about these kind of private-public partnerships, about bringing private money in, whether it's corporate or foundation, and some of the strings attached?
It's been the case for years and years that Berkeley, like other major universities, have gone to foundations for support. But as I understand it, the important thing is to ensure that there are no strings attached, that the gifts that are made, the partnerships that are entered into and agreed upon are ones that fulfill the mission that has been defined here independent of those needs. That being said, I think we have to be more nimble in terms of taking advantage of opportunities that do exist here in the Bay Area in California. It is clear that another institution down in the Silicon Valley has been especially nimble.
Stanford?
I think that's the name of it. I just have been told never to wear my red shirts or
red ties
again, but aside from that. And there are some things that one can learn from that. And there certainly are a lot of people who are in the Bay Area, including in the Silicon Valley, who have interests in the kind of skills, the kind of expertise, the kinds of facilities, the kinds of programs that are going on here at Berkeley, of which we can probably take better advantage.
And that's Nicholas Dirks. He's the new chancellor of UC Berkeley. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. So you mentioned the S word, but you came from Columbia, from a private institution to, you know, the premier public institution in California and some would say in the world. What appealed to you about this job?
Berkeley has been not just the preeminent public university in California or in the nation. And I believe it is still that. But it's been, in fact, one of the best universities in the world by any standard. And, you know, so for an academic like me, I mean, Berkeley has always been the gold standard. It's always been one of the very top universities anywhere in the world to work at. Yes, I do come from a private university. Before that, I had been at the University of Michigan, another very fine public institution. And the move from Michigan to Columbia had some cultural adjustments that went along with it. But at the same time, I will say that even within the set of Ivy League institutions, Columbia, partly because it's in New York, partly because it's been a slightly less wealthy and well-endowed institution than some of its peers, has prepared me well for Berkeley. It's been a place that has been deeply committed to academic excellence. It's been one of the great universities of the 20th century and 21st, certainly. But it's also been a place because of its location, because of its mission, that has put a lot of effort into the diversity of its student body, the diversity of its faculty, increasingly into its relations with the community, and it is, of course, in Harlem. And so in that sense, I don't feel that there's a huge break taking place. But at the same time, one of the things that I hear repeatedly as I talk to groups both on campus and alumni groups at various clubs and other receptions and meetings I've had over the course of the last few months, I keep hearing this great pride in the institution, but also a great sense of commitment and loyalty to the institution because of its being public. And that, to me, is very exciting. It adds a dimension to life here that, to me, is like having your cake and eating it, too.
How do you feel about online education? That's something that Governor Jerry Brown is a big proponent of, and it's, you know, kind of big here in the Bay Area, and some experiments have worked well and some have failed miserably. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, first, interestingly enough, we at Columbia began a whole venture in online education in the 1990s that turned out to fail. It was another version of the dot-com bubble that didn't quite work out. And I look at some of the debates about MOOCs, that is to say these massive open online courses that dominate the discussion about online education now. And I think, well, you know, we don't even know what these are going to look like in 2 or 3 years. So much has happened even in the last year and a half. So every month the landscape changes. But at the same time, we know that that online is here. I mean, all students are using online technology as they're taking their courses. Now, obviously, there are questions that will have to be addressed about, you know, who gets credit, under what kinds of conditions, how performance is evaluated, what it means to differentiate between online and more traditional residential forms of education. But, you know, nothing's going to be resolved right away. Unfortunately, there's no magic bullet. This is not going to reduce costs. In fact, right now, I think it costs more to develop a course online than it does just to have it taught in the old way with lecture notes, however dusty they might be. It costs less to dust them off. But the short answer is, I don't think there's something that's going to replace residential education anytime soon. I certainly hope not. And we are going to have to work very hard to keep engaging in serious and productive ways with the opportunities that exist out there without making some serious mistakes by trying something that will end up shortchanging students and not really doing the kinds of things that that we want to do here.
So as you mentioned, we're here in 2013. You just started this job. It's hard to predict the future into, you know, so many parts of the world are changing so quickly that it's hard to look 5 or even 10 years into the future. But I'm going to ask you to do that. You're a historian. You can handle this. What do you want your legacy to be?
I would like to think of several things. First of all, I would like the undergraduate experience at Berkeley to be thought of generally, that is able to rival the best kind of liberal arts undergraduate experience in the smallest and most well-endowed New England private school. Because I believe that what Berkeley can offer for, you know, the citizens of the state of California and indeed the citizens of the world is the best of both worlds, a context in which they can have this engaged and very connected kind of education. That then introduces them to the extraordinary resources of the university at large. But to make clear the centrality of and the excellence of the undergraduate experience at a place like Berkeley would be something I would like to have remembered, and the importance and the continued importance of the liberal arts as the base then for everything that students go on to do, whether it's doing advanced work in medicine, in high-energy particle physics, or in nanoscience and the fabrication of new kinds of materials that are going to make for a different kind of built environment in the 21st and later centuries.
Nicholas Dirks is the new chancellor of UC Berkeley. So how do you think California's public universities should be funded? You can join our discussion at Facebook. We're KALW. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Many government institutions are struggling these days. The United States Postal Service is among them. One way the Postal Service has been trying to make money is by selling off its properties. More than 600 buildings have been targeted with a total projected savings of more than $2 billion. The sales could pay off in raising short-term capital, but the long-term consequences bother many people, including Gray Brecken. He's a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley just up the hill from the downtown Berkeley Post Office, one of those set for sale. Brecken is the founder of the Living New Deal Project, which looks at public works built in an effort to help lift the country out of the Great Depression. KALW's Ben Trefney sat down with Brecken to discuss the significance of the post office properties.
What we've forgotten is that these buildings are unique to the United States. They are in every small town. They're often the finest buildings in many small towns, and they're palaces in our major cities. And there's a reason for that. And it's basically because these buildings represented the federal presence all across the United States. That's why so many of them have artworks in them, public artworks that were designed specifically for those spaces. This was for the first time an opportunity for Americans to see themselves reflected back to themselves, their legends, their history, their landscapes, but above all, the work that they did. So the idea is to uplift the American public by creating noble surroundings. We've forgotten that.
So now this historic building in Berkeley, which has been the central post office in the city, is being considered for sale. What exactly is happening with the post office in Berkeley?
The U.S. Postal Service announced that it was going to sell Berkeley's downtown post office, a building which is nearly 100 years old. It is, by all measures, a beautiful building modeled after a famous Renaissance building in Florence by Brunelleschi. And it's been a center of community for nearly a century. And they're now going to sell it and then move to another space, which they don't own, presumably somewhere in the downtown. This makes no sense, actually, to give up a building that you own to move into space that you don't own, unless you are the real estate company that's brokering the sale. And that company is CBRE, which is owned and operated by Richard C. Blum, Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband.
Well, it's quite well publicized that the Postal Service is in real dire economic straits. So for them to be able to make quick cash in any way might be really helpful for their sustainability. I mean, they're already canceling Saturday service for regular mail. So in this way, if they have a beautiful building, perhaps they can make a lot of money right away and shore up their finances.
The Postal Service actually has a portfolio of real estate, which was paid for by my parents and grandparents, that's estimated to be worth $105 billion.
So, including the downtown Berkeley Post Office.
Including the downtown Post Office. And it's represented by buildings and property all over the United States. Now, the artworks in our post offices are literally priceless.
Which are often permanent because they've been painted into them or created within the buildings themselves.
Yes. Most of the artworks in the post offices are murals, but there's also a lot of sculpture as well, too.
Do you know what Blum and his company plan to do with the post office if the sale goes through?
Blum will do nothing, or I should say Richard Blum's company, CBRE, will do nothing with the building themselves. They're simply the brokers. Now, they have really a privileged position because they not only broker the sales of our buildings, but they advise the Postal Service on which ones to sell. So it's not surprising that the first ones going on the market are in some of the most upscale towns and cities in the country.
Which also might be some of the most valuable.
A very valuable property in Palo Alto, La Jolla, and Burlingame and other cities. But they also apparently lease out the space back to the Postal Service, which it doesn't own. So this makes no sense, actually, except in the short term, to liquidate your properties and then lease on long term properties that you don't own in other parts.
That's Gray Brecken, a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley and founder of the Living New Deal Project. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. In March, the Berkeley City Council voted unanimously to oppose the sale of the post office and asked for a one-year moratorium on any decision about its sale. Berkeley Mayor Tom Bates and other local and state officials have sent an appeal to the USPS and are still awaiting a decision. You can find out more about that appeal and other proposed post office sales at KALW.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Tiffany Kamhai.
Goodbye, Tiffany. We'll miss you.
Jen Chien, Chris Hoff, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Teddy Lederer, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, Nina Gensler-Debs, Holly McDeed, and Daniel Moore. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, KALW is independent, listener-supported public radio. It's summertime even in San Francisco, so it's a good time to hear Wendy DeWitt, Queen of the Boogie Woogie. Her music in the tradition of Chicago blues and Texas Boogie Woogie has a reputation for filling the dance floor. If that sounds fun to you, you can hear Wendy DeWitt at the newly renovated Pier 23 Cafe on San Francisco's Embarcadero. She'll be playing a free show there on Wednesday starting at 6 p.m. For more information, go to our website. It's KALW.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.